For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, state lawmakers elect their new leaders during organizational day in the lead up to the 2019 legislative session. Atoka Representative Charles McCall was reelected as House Speaker, while Oklahoma City Senator Greg Treat was elected as President Pro Tem. Neva, what do you think of these leaders?
Well, I think, first of all, no surprise. We knew who would be leading both in the House and the Senate this session. I think organization day is always kind of that trigger point. The Constitution dictates that they come in and formally make these elections known and also certify the results from, you know, the November elections. But I think we've got strong leadership teams in both the House and the Senate, and with the new incoming Republican governor, I think it sets up for a very interesting session.
Ryan.
Well, and I think you're seeing some efforts within the Republican caucus, especially in the House, to begin to put some salve on the fractures that occurred during the last legislative session. There's the there's the formation of the Platform Caucus, only two of whom are coming back this legislative cycle, this legislative session. As a result, in large part, because, you know, folks didn't run for re-election, but then some others were targeted by nearly $1 million in independent expenditures raised by leadership in the House Republican Caucus. And so we've seen some rules come out of their caucus retreat saying that they've got a new rule that they're not going to target other members for opposition during campaigns. They're not going to recruit candidates against members. We'll see how they enforce that or how that holds up. But we've seen some of those platform members put in, the two returning put in prominent committee chair positions, and I think that we're beginning to try to see this kumbaya moment within the House Republican caucus as they walk back into the session.
And I think it was interesting, too, the tone that was set in terms of both Speaker McCall and the comments that he made, as well as Senate Pro Tem Treat. I mean, talking about that they would work across political party lines, and that there would be, I mean, really a tone that was about doing what was best for all Oklahomans. And so I think it was not this hard partisan divide that we really saw, or any kind of shrill rhetoric. I think it was this overarching theme of it's time that we come together and do good things for the state of Oklahoma.
And meanwhile, on the other side of that, for the first time in state history, both minority leaders are women, with Norman Representative Emily Virgin leading in the House and Oklahoma City Senator Kay Floyd leading in the Senate. Ryan, your thoughts on those two?
Well, and if you dig a little deeper, you know, one of the things that we've seen, one of the national narratives in Congress has been the growing diversity in Congress, in particular in the Democratic caucus, and we're starting to see that reflected in Oklahoma as well. So not only do we have at the leadership position with Senator Floyd and Representative Virgin leading their caucuses in the Senate and the House respectively, but the caucus chair in the House, you've got Cindy Munson, Representative Cindy Munson. Vice chair is Monroe Nichols. You know, so you're beginning to see women and minorities take really strong leadership positions within this caucus. I think it's exciting. It's going to bring some needed diversity of perspective to these important roles in the House. And I think that it's really a harbinger of things to come for the way the Democratic caucus is going to better represent and better reflect the people of Oklahoma.
And when you talk about women, the House caucus chair is also a woman, a Representative Tammy West out of the Northwest Oklahoma City Bethany area, and so I think we are seeing this emerging strong group of women that are assuming very significant leadership positions, some very quickly. I mean, Representative West is only in her second term in office. So
Senator Kim David. is going to be floor leader in the Senate. That is a huge position, one of the most powerful positions in the legislature. Republican, and yet another female taking a leadership role in the legislature. It's exciting stuff.
Also, during Tuesday's organizational day, state representatives passed rules governing the upcoming session, including a ban on recording videos by lawmakers on the House floor. Other controversial rules included allowing bills to progress without a Senate author and waiving the 48-hour notification on hearings. Ryan, your thoughts on these rules?
Yeah, the ban on live streaming from the House floor, I really think that, you know, we saw during the last legislative session, during the teacher walkout, a legislator kind of made a fool of himself with a live stream and, you know, paid some political price for that for that live stream. I think that they're trying, I think leadership is trying to protect members from themselves. I also think they're trying to protect not only from the folks that are actually doing the live streaming from saying something in the heat of the moment, but getting a hot mic moment where you're live streaming and the person next to you says something. You know, frankly, if you can't control yourself and act with the kind of decorum that if it were picked up by a microphone on the House floor or on the Senate floor, maybe you shouldn't be there. Yeah, I think that this rule really strikes in the face of the way that a lot of lawmakers at the federal, state, and local level are beginning to communicate directly to their constituents and giving their constituents a real on-the-ground view of what it's like to be there. But maybe the most troubling rule is this elimination of the 48-hour notice. You know, that, as it plays out during the session, could have profound effects on the way that legislation moves and the amount of notice that not only legislators have, but maybe more importantly, the amount of notice that citizens have that a particular bill or a particular subject is going to come up for a vote and their opportunity to weigh in or be at the Capitol for that bill.
Neva.
Well, on the issue of being able to have this notification issue, I think you have to remember that they always had the opportunity to suspend the rules and to move something on a faster track. I mean, now what this does is basically give more power to the speaker in that process. But I think the other thing that was just mentioned in terms of the videoing, it's important to note that there are media divisions in both the House and the Senate. There is archived videos and audio of each and every session, of every comment made live on debate on the floor and all that ensues within both of those chambers. So they're not negating the public's ability to know what's going on. I think what may be more important in that process is they are developing a decorum and an ability to be able to conduct the business without this kind of gotcha mentality of people going going rogue with the live streaming or the live Facebook or whatever it happened, they happen to be using. So I think the hour-long debate on the House side is somewhat indicative of that chamber and the rancor that goes back and forth. The Senate stream, basically went through and almost with no debate passed their rules. So
I think Treat's speech was longer.
Exactly. So I think you kind of see the kind of the character of both of those chambers, once again emerging. But bottom line is we always see some tweaks in the rules and the back and forth. Most of them are hammered out by their respective caucuses long before they make the formal vote on it. And I don't think there were really any big surprises out of it as a takeaway.
I did find it interesting, though, the one where you don't need a Senate author because if you don't have a Senate author, really it doesn't go anywhere. It's just going to sit in the House. You can pass it all the way through the House. But if without a Senate author, no one can pick it up in the other chamber.
And I know that that's a revision of a rule. And if I think back, that rule itself that you have to have a Senate author isn't that old. And I think that the autonomy at I think that we should just have one chamber. I think we should eliminate either the Senate or the House and have a unicameral legislature. But until we do that, I think that we should respect the autonomy of each chamber.
Until
we do that, we'd save a lot of money, have fewer politicians and more voices. But, that's another topic. But I think that, so until we do that, we should respect the autonomy of the chambers. That one doesn't bother me as much. On Neva's point about the fact that they could always suspend the rules, that is absolutely right. But it required a vote, and it was a two-thirds vote. It was a difficult hurdle. And finally, if I were still in the House, and there aren't very many days that I still wish that I were in the House, but if I were still in the House, I would live stream on day one and see what they did.
There you go. The state of Oklahoma is getting ready to welcome its new governor. This coming weekend includes inaugural celebrations such as a family festival at the Oklahoma Aquarium in Tulsa, followed by a black tie ball in Tulsa later that evening. This all culminates in the inauguration on Monday, followed by the inaugural ball on Monday night. Neva, what do you think of the upcoming party?
I think it's a typical inauguration series of events throughout a weekend leading up to the inauguration next Monday, starting at 11:30. And I think Kevin Stitt is our 28th governor coming in. I mean, he is setting a a tone of trying to be inclusive. It actually starts in Lawton with the pre-inaugural festivities down there that are very oriented to try to, you know, bring in large groups of people, lower dollar costs. So you really have the gamut in terms of the Jinx event, very family-oriented, foster families being encouraged to participate and being allowed to come in for free. And many of the, I think, the designated benefactors of some of the money that will be raised will be some of those groups in the Tulsa area. And that is an issue that clearly the incoming First Lady has said is something near and dear to her heart and that she will be very actively involved in. And I think her advocacy certainly will elevate the whole conversation in terms of foster families and in Oklahoma. So I think it is it's a naturally exciting time to see a transition in power, whether it's at the state level or at the national level, and it will be very interesting to see the tone and some of the specifics that Kevin Stitt outlines in his inaugural address Monday afternoon.
Ryan.
Yeah, and I think that's right. It's the honeymoon, and this is what we're going to go through. I have an app on my phone that pops up old photograph memories, and it's probably tracking all sorts of things. But yeah, as it's been popping up over the last week, I'm getting all these photos of the inauguration of Brad Henry, you know, from, I think it was like 12 years ago right now. So, you know, it's quite quite a ways back from like the last one of those.
Oh, the second
inaugural. Yeah, the second inaugural with, you know, yeah. And so, you know, seeing all of that stuff, you know, it is, and it's an exciting time for the state. And, you know, if you think about the outgoing administration, you know, we had at the ACLU, we had an open records request that was 1 year and 11 months old that Governor Fallon just responded to. So it's like they're cleaning out their drawers and saying, well, we might as well get that done. So, I mean, it's an exciting time for the state, and the inaugural address on Monday is when the real work begins. Not that there hasn't been work going on, but it's really that's going to set the tone, because up until now, I don't think that we've seen a real concrete idea of what Governor Stitt or Governor-elect Stitt hopes to see come out of this legislative session. We've seen some, you know, larger overarching goals, but we haven't really seen any sort of details yet.
And I think we won't see a lot of detail perhaps in the inaugural address. I think that will be for the state of the state. But I think what we will see is, again, this expanding vision of how he really sees himself as governor of the state of Oklahoma. I think some of the things that he certainly put in place as recently as just this past week with the concept of a chief operating officer, someone who's going to be cabinet level, that really is going to be tasked with really achieving some real accountability out of these state agency heads and directors. And he continues to advocate for wanting to be a governor who can hire and fire those folks. And that's going to be, I think, one of his chief priorities in trying to accomplish during this legislative session. And we'll see how both the lawmakers as well as the public respond to that.
And that's going to be, I think, one of the more interesting dynamics this legislative session is, that in a one-party state where you may have basic agreement from the Republican caucus and the Senate and the House and Governor Stitt, you know, there is going to be, I think, a more internal conversation and perhaps debate over executive power, over who is going to drive this train. For the last 8 years, it's been Republicans in the legislature that drove the train, and Governor Fallon was largely just on board for the ride. And unfortunately for her, ended up getting blamed for a lot of the bad stuff that did or didn't happen. But you know, the legislature drove the train, and I think Governor Stitt is coming in with an idea as an executive, as a manager. He wants to have a lot more control over the way the state operates. And I think that even though we're seeing some talk out of the legislature about greater transparency and accountability, who actually holds that power, whether it's the executive or the legislature, that's going to be an interesting debate that happens this session.
Well, and I think you have a guy who ran for governor intending to be a change maker. I mean, he didn't move out of a very prominent and successful business position and move into the political arena wanting to just be a placeholder. I mean, I think he's made it pretty clear across the board and in conversations, certainly through this transition period with the folks that have been involved, that that it's time to really mix things up. It's time to really deal with these issues, quit talking about them, but let's figure out how to fix them. And I think the public will be very, very receptive and very positive on that. And the proof will be in what, you know, what transpires in being able to work together with these lawmakers and others to achieve some real successes.
Epic Charter School is getting nearly $39 million from the state after a boost in enrollment for the virtual school. In fact, 12 charter schools, including 4 virtual schools, made the top 20 list of institutions getting more money. Meanwhile, 2 of the biggest public schools, Oklahoma City and Tulsa, are getting their funding cut by more than $2 million each. Ryan, what do you think about these mid-year adjustments?
Well, I think that the mid-year adjustments, I mean, this is something that typically happens. And the good news is that because of the new revenue streams that are coming into the state as a result of the budget deal that happened during the last legislative session, these mid-year adjustments don't mean that a lot of schools are, even schools that are getting increases, are getting letters from the state saying we can't do that. You know, so this is a good year in terms of, you know, if you're due additional money, you're probably going to get that additional money. We're not seeing some cuts across the board because of these mid-year adjustments. I think that the one thing that's going to come out of this is increased scrutiny on these charter schools, and in particular on online charter schools. There is, I think, a real bipartisan appetite to make sure that the enrollment, you know, the people that are showing up are people that, are they actually completing the school years? There's a lot of transparency and accountability issues that have been addressed by the legislature over the last couple of years. And I think that this year, in particular with these kind of numbers, you're going to see the legislature begin to act. And the way that charter schools are administered and overseen by the state of Oklahoma will probably change this session.
Neva.
I would agree. I mean, based on even many of the pre-filed bills, right. I mean, there's every indication that this is going to be a topic that's going to be front and center. And I think the issue, when you really look at not only Oklahoma City and Tulsa, but the other 3 in the top 5 schools that were the biggest losers in terms of the funding were Broken Arrow, Owosso, and Moore. So you take those 5 school districts, 5 of the largest in the state, and then you look at these increases that are very dramatic in terms of the numbers with the charter schools, virtual schools. I think coming to terms with what that looks like long term, and as Ryan says, and the accountability piece and the structural pieces that now have to really, I think everyone has to pause and say we've really got to take a serious look at. And I do think this is a bipartisan issue because it's an education issue, it's an Oklahoma issue because it deals with every kid and what we do in terms of giving them the quality education they deserve.
And when you're talking about these cuts in enrollment, Oklahoma City's new superintendent has basically said it's time to start closing some schools. It's time. So when you say, look, some of these schools, they don't even have the number of students that it takes to fill these. When you get these kinds of numbers, is it just more impetus to the superintendent to say, it's time to close these schools?
Or it may be time to think outside the box. Perhaps some of these larger school districts need to look at becoming 2 school districts and not just 1 school district. That is, in terms of numbers, proven time and time again that they can't get wrap their heads around being able to efficiently deal with it in terms of cost, numbers of students, buildings, teachers, all that it encompasses. And so I think they have a climate now in an environment where there would be a lot of support for some serious look at what can we do differently and better. And, I think the challenge, particularly in these larger school districts, is you need to start thinking about doing it as quickly as possible.
And I think that if you look at, like Neva said, the pre-bill filings that we've seen on charter schools, one of the things that legislators are struggling with right now is that they don't have a full grasp on, you know, what these charter school enrollment numbers actually look like and what their performance looks like. And the things that we have grown accustomed to trying to measure, maybe Oklahoma City Public Schools or Owosso or Broken Arrow, the things that we measure them on, number of students that are there every day that complete the semester and how they do over the course of several years in that school district, that information, as imperfect and incomplete as that is, I think lawmakers feel is a much better picture than what they're getting coming out of charter schools right now.
Well, and when you look at some of these districts, and oftentimes, again, again in these larger school districts. I mean, the number of kids that are bounced out of these districts, and where do they land? And is this the logical place that they do land? And, you know, trying to see where the real streamlining, not only streamlining is, but where the ability to really garner information on both sides of that attendance process is very difficult right now, because they don't really have the structure, the matrix, and the, you know, and the kind of the internal workings set up to really do that. And I think that's where the State Department and everyone have to get on board about working together, not trying to kind of divide and conquer, you know, and not work well with each other, which historically has been one of our biggest problems.
So you think it won't be as much of a hands-off? It's always been kind of a hands-off of on the charter schools from state lawmakers. Do you think this time it's going to be, we actually need to figure out what's going on?
I think they're going to take a hard look at everything, and this will be one, you know, one aspect that will not be, you know, not be set aside and kind of, you know, separated out. I think everything's going to be on the table, and hopefully that will be the case.
Outgoing Lieutenant Governor Todd Lamb is heading into the private sector. The Oklahoman reported earlier this week Lamb will take a position as Chief Development Officer for Tricor. The company specializes in cybersecurity and has operations in 10 states. Neva, it's not surprising to see the former Secret Service agent staying in the security field.
That's right. And I think, you know, here Todd Lamb, who was in the state Senate and two terms as lieutenant governor, and now the day after he leaves office, he's back in the private sector in a very significant role within this, you know, this private company. And I think well suited. I mean, by every estimation, not only by the folks that hired him and the things, very complimentary things that they said, but, I mean, here's someone, the 12 states, the District of Columbia that they operate in. They're a very high-tech, very successful company that really, I mean, in terms of his skill set, I mean, it looks like it's kind of the perfect match. And, you know, I certainly wish Lieutenant Governor Lamb, as he leaves office, great success in his work in private enterprise, and thank him for his years of public service, because he's been an exemplary public servant.
Right.
Well, and it keeps him in Oklahoma City. I think that, you know, he's young. He has, some political aspirations ahead of him. You know, so where he was going to ultimately land, I think, was going to give some sense of where he thought that political operation may be in the future. I sincerely doubt that his days of running for office are over. I don't know what that is, but I mean, he's somebody who obviously, you know, likes public service and has an affinity for running for office. And so, you know, for him to be in the Oklahoma City area, you know, that tells us where his base of political operations are going to be in the future. And this is just something we're seeing. You know, this, you know, we've seen folks that have been in these offices for a while. They're coming out, they're going into the private sector. I was down at the Devon cafeteria the other day eating lunch and ran into my old friend Ken Miller, who I served with in the legislature, went on to become state treasurer, and said, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm a businessman now. I'm a company man. He's working at OG&E now. Yeah. And so all these folks that have held these positions, in particular statewide positions, transitioning out, going into the private sector, and, you know, I think for the most part, when we see that, they're bringing an enormous amount of skill set to private industry. And I think that, you know, there is some concern about, you know, how does their influence stay over, and, you know, should there be cooling off periods? Oh, those are interesting conversations. But, you know, all in all, with, you know, what I'm seeing right now, I'm grateful that these folks have, you know, found some good jobs and going to be able to keep paying their mortgages.
Yeah, and Todd Lamb's not going in as like a legislative liaison. Yeah. He's going as a chief development officer. So he's taking his skill set, and he's actually going away completely.
Well, clearly, if they're in 12 states and D.C., I mean, they've got a lot of other opportunities in many other states. And let's look at it from this standpoint also, from the private sector standpoint. Here's someone who has had an opportunity to know a lot of folks in a lot of states, in the business communities, certainly because as lieutenant governor, he was very proactive in terms of, you know, bringing, you know, looking to bring business and industry into the state. So he's got a real leg up over a lot of folks in terms of just that wealth of information and contacts that he has across the country that that will bode well for him in this job. And as you say, Ryan, he elected to stay in the state. His kids are still in school. He wants to see them, you know, complete their education here. It gives him an opportunity to continue to do things, you know, in terms of family and church and other, you know, related activities that he cares about. And so, you know, as we see these people, you know, kind of make this transition from the public sector to the private sector, it's fascinating to see where they land.
Yeah, and you know, historically, if we look at folks, I mean, some, you know, take the Fred Harris model and, you know, just totally abscond
move,
to
move to Albuquerque move, and become a University of New Mexico professor.
Or they stick around the state. And so, I mean, I think that it is interesting to see what are those first steps when they leave office. And like you said, you know, especially these statewide elected officials, they walk out with a Rolodex. And if you don't know what a Rolodex is and you're listening, Google it. They leave with a Rolodex that is, you know, second to none. And it's difficult to replicate that anywhere else. And one of the most important things, if you're a company and you're hiring these people that have names that people recognize, you get doors opened. Yeah. And that's a big, big advantage to you if you're hiring one of these folks.
Ryan's and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.